We have a few good bills on our agenda today. We will go slightly out of order, seeing how Representative Morissette is here to talk about House Bill 2829. We open a public hearing on House Bill 2829. Mr. Putman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, when someone buys a business that has lottery machines in it, they can't operate those machines until they have the new owner has a permit to operate it. And the Lottery Commission will sometimes take that equipment out, and 6 weeks, 2 months later, when the person gets their license to go into the lottery business, the machines are brought back. This bill is to make it possible for the Lottery Commission to grant a temporary license while they do the necessary processing before granting a full license.
Okay, Representative Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good
afternoon. And members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and talk about a bill that did pass out of the House 52-1. I'm not sure why we had that one negative vote, but it was there. No matter how good an idea is, there's... I'm Representative Bill Morissette, District 42. I'm sorry. I can't get used to it on this side of the microphone. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the reason that I introduced this bill was on behalf of two constituents, one of whom, well, both of whom had a lottery license in the past. One of them, well, both of them in a grocery store, one of them bought the liquor store and submitted his application for the license, and as you will hear in other testimony to follow, there were some delays and partly his fault and partly some confusion. I was in the store the day that he took over, and that was the day they carried out the equipment, and it was out for, I believe, at least 6 weeks. The other constituent had owned a grocery store and had a liquor license in the past and was reapplying for a lottery license and was reapplying for his new grocery store. And he went through the same experience. There was a long delay and the license being granted, and the equipment was removed from the store, and again, he lost revenue and the state lost revenue in the process. So the bill that I had drafted simply said that it was permissive in nature, saying that they may issue a temporary permit, a temporary letter of authority, knowing that there may be reasons why they shouldn't be mandated to do this. It leaves the door open for, and it also says they could withdraw it at any time. Now, in the meantime, the Lottery Commission did change their rules to allow a temporary contract, which accomplishes the same thing. That was not there when I drafted the legislation. Now, my concern is that the state police might insist at a later time that they want to do the entire investigation before the permit is issued, as they have in the past. And as you will hear from Mr. Hooper, they drafted this change in October, which was after my constituents went through their situation, and it was after long negotiation with the state police in order to get them to relax their insistence that they do a heavy-duty investigation beforehand. So you will hear that they're already doing this, and what's the need for legislation? My concern is what any administrative rule that is put into place can be taken out at any time, and I don't want a future administrator to say, well, we can't do this because the statutes do not allow us to give this temporary contract or temporary letter. So it is permissive in nature. There is a disagreement about the terms letter of authority as opposed to temporary letter, or temporary contract as opposed to temporary letter of authority. As I told the House Committee on Smart Growth, I don't really care what they call it, just as long as it's there. The chair of the committee and the majority of the committee, however, felt that there was nothing wrong with using the words temporary letter of authority. Now, Mr. Hooper will explain his point of view, and I don't think that there's opposition to the concept, and there was some concern about the language that was used. And so with that, I will end my remarks, and if you have any questions, I'd be very happy to answer.
Mr. Chair,
and Robin, go ahead.
I do have a question, and thank you. Good afternoon, Representative Morissette. part of the state police investigation then would be relaxed under the lottery rules that would allow for a temporary contract.
Well, I think what Mr. Hooper will say is that the state police would prefer to do the full-blown background check before anything is issued, and I think what this would allow is if there is a two-day background check or a short check and nothing serious pops up, that they can go ahead and issue this temporary letter of authority, and then if something comes up that they miss, they can immediately withdraw this temporary letter of authority, and they will continue to do their full-blown background check, which does take more than 2 days, I understand.
I see.
Now, if I may, Chair Beyer, Senator Gortley, I guess my wonderment is that if a person had a particularly a lottery license in the past, and there were no black marks or no concerns about anything that had happened, that there wouldn't have to be as thorough a background check, or at least a temporary authority, a letter would make a lot of sense if they had already been operating as a licensed lottery dispenser. Now, a brand new person, I guess this would apply to a person who had never operated the lottery before, but again, if nothing jumped out immediately, that they would go ahead and issue this temporary license. And it was pretty traumatic when it was around noon, the day that the person took the liquor store over, and the agent came in and removed all the equipment. Now, the agent knew this operator from his previous grocery store where he had lottery equipment, and he was very apologetic about having to remove it. But it was gone for about 6 weeks. And so it's just something that I think is very inflexible. And I'd like to have a statutory reference that it's okay to do this for future administrative rule changes that might occur.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Hooper?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Hooper. I'm Public Affairs Manager with the Oregon Lottery. Based on my discussions with Representative Morissette regarding the genesis of this bill, I believe the application process is already in place, address the concerns raised by his constituents. We do, in fact, in statute, have the ability to issue temporary contracts. We now use that to do the very thing he's trying to do. In the past, we used to issue contracts ahead of time under what was known as the sale of business rule, where an individual wishing to purchase an existing lottery establishment or an existing business could come in and apply, be approved for a lottery contract prior to actually taking possession of the business. In both cases, the equipment is simply shut down for 24 hours. That's to close the books on the old account and then open new books on the new retailer. We understand the business owner's desire to be up and running as soon as possible. Minimizing downtime is money for both them and the state. We recognize that. That's why we put the sale of business rule in place in 97 and in our temporary contract in full force in October of 2000. Representative Morissette is quite correct. The bill is permissive. It does not require us to issue temporary letters of authority. He alluded to some technicalities. And the Attorney General's office looked at this and said a letter of authority conflicts with other statutes that require a contract to be in place. By statutory definition, a lottery game retailer means a person with whom the Lottery Commission has contracted for the purpose of selling tickets, and the bill itself said the temporary letter of authority does not constitute a contract. Furthermore, a video lottery game terminal shall be placed for operation only on the premises that has a contract with the lottery. So I'm not sure we could ever really use a temporary letter of authority, at least by statutory definition, to accomplish what he wants to do. And again, with our temporary contract, which statute does allow, I think we've really addressed these. And again, we would always move cautiously before implementing a blanket letter of authority. We do have an obligation to do background checks on people to make sure they don't have any criminal background history, that they have the financial wherewithal to be good, responsible retailers, be good managers of those funds they're collecting on part of the, on behalf of the state and then transferring to us. There is no disagreement between Representative Morissette and the lottery in terms of the goals of this bill. I would simply restate that we've tried in the past to address this. The individuals who experienced problems with us did not avail themselves to the sale of business rule. They kind of showed up at the 11th hour. And if they were to show up today and ask for a temporary contract, we could do that background check in about 2 days' time and accomplish that. So statute does, in fact, codify the ability to issue a temporary contract, and we do work very hard with all the constituents to give them the best service we can. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Hooper? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Putnam, do we have additional witnesses?
No, ma'am.
Any additional comments or concerns from the committee? Close the hearing on House Bill 2829 and open the work session on House Bill 2829.
Madam Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 2829 with 403 passed recommendations.
Senator Starr moves House Bill 2829 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any objection?
Well, the good representative is still in the building, so we've got to shoot the dog in front of him, I guess. Just kidding. Just kidding.
So ordered. Carrier? Senator Portman. Thank you. Mr. Putman, I believe we'll go back to the top of the agenda.
That's fine. Yeah.
And open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2245.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to refer to vote?
Oh, this looks like it.
Hey, that's a big thing.
Is this? This yours?
No.
It says Tyler.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2245 conforms existing law to actual practice. Boilers are no longer measured in their capacity in terms of the number of square feet of heating surface. Rather, they're measured in terms of their horsepower of output. This bill adopts the new language, doesn't actually change any fees, as I understand it.
Thank you, Mr. Brewer.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. As always, Mr. Putnam has done a very thorough job of explaining the bill. This action was is really related to an action taken by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers to eliminate from its nomenclature the effective heating surface of a boiler. We're proposing to change to boiler horsepower, which should be an easy calculation for those who know how to do that calculation. The bill should be revenue neutral. We've worked to try and ensure there's no significant change in fees one way or the other. I'd be happy to answer any questions, should there be any.
I don't see any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close public hearing, open work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Harper.
I'll move House Bill 2245 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Hartley moves House Bill 2245 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Doesn't have any amendments or motions twice either.
Well, that's two in a row.
And Mr. Chair.
Is there any further discussion? Yes, Mr. Harper.
I'll declare a conflict of interest possible. I do operate a boiler of 15 horsepower.
What was the question?
With or without the bill, yeah.
What?
I don't know whether I need to or not.
Listen.
This law applies to me.
Yes, is that in your business?
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. I'm a boiler mechanic. It's pretty scary. Yeah.
All right. I've always wondered what these boilers
did. They think they get off the ground down there in Cape Cod.
Any other discussion?
Do you have boiler?
Any objections?
Is that what you said?
The order. Senator Harper volunteered to carry the bill.
I'll take care of you, Joe.
That was good testimony. You hear that?
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2254.
All right. Rolling. Keep them.
Mr. Putnam.
Mr. Chairman, right now, under, I believe, the Administrative Procedures Act, there's a requirement that certain people be represented by an attorney before the Construction Contractors Board. There are circumstances where there seems to be agreement that an attorney is not needed. This gives the board authority to set forth the circumstances under which you don't have to be represented by an attorney before the board.
Thank you. Ken, I see you wore the correct tie today.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, Byer, members of the committee, I'm Ken Cudell. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board.
I told him I wouldn't even entertain housekeeping bills unless he wore that tie.
But he did not have that tie on Friday.
He didn't?
Well,
he didn't get any bills out either.
Nothing back either.
Oh, that wasn't entertaining.
Do you teach people to dress badly so that you don't embarrass them badly?
Senator Byer and I did about 9,000 bills for Construction Contractor Board last year. Didn't we have that whole committee just for you?
Yes.
So why are they back this year? What did you guys do wrong? Then Harper, would you figure this out, please?
Go ahead, Adele. Ignore this group up here.
Does this have an emergency clause?
The genesis of this bill is because of the limited liability company coming into existence. But in this time, what the proposed language in 2254 would allow the board by rule to expand this in case legislature comes up with additional entities that might be created to do business in the state of Oregon. The owners of that business ought to be able to appear representing that company before hearings before the Construction Contractors Board, and that's basically what this does. We looked at putting it into similar language in ORS 183-457, but that's primarily geared to single-party actions, and mostly what we're concerned here with are claims, where you got one party is filing a claim against the other. The Construction Contractors Board is more the referee in that case. So didn't quite fit 183, decided we needed it in our own statute. It's already there. A corporate officer can represent a corporation before the Construction Contractors Board. This expands it to other entities. And the system has worked well. They know when they need an attorney, but in many cases, it's a very simple issue, and they ought to be able to represent their company.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
The only concern I'd have is that would it be, is it a position that a contractor could take out that because he or she didn't have an attorney present, that they could then pursue an appeal on the basis that they weren't appropriately represented?
Chair Beyer, Senator Corcoran, the notice that they get before a hearing so indicates that they're entitled to an attorney. So they can't plead that they didn't know that they weren't entitled to an attorney. Okay. But that's been plugged. We've never had that occur okay. In any case.
That was my only question about this, Chair.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
I have one other question.
Senator Corcoran.
If they had to hear all these damn bills in 1999, why didn't you do this one then?
Chair Beyer, Senator, we weren't aware of the problem that we had with the limited liability company. It was just coming into existence. And
we didn't make those, Senator Corcoran.
When did the limited liability company? I thought they've been around for a while.
Limited liability company, Senator Chair Beyer, has been around for a period of time, but it's just in the last 2 years that they've become the most popular form of organization for construction contractors.
And why is that?
They were only lawyers.
Limited liability. It's the best of partnership and best of corporations. I would say that 50% of those who used to go corporations or more are now limited liability companies.
I think that we changed the rules last session on how to form limited liability companies and partnerships, and that may have made it easier for companies to transfer into that form of ownership. Close the public hearing. Open work session. House Bill 2254.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gorley moves House Bill 2254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? Done deal. Senator Deckard wants to carry it. Glad to.
No, Jason's still on.
That's it.
Yeah.
All right. No amendments again. Or emergency clauses. Okay, open a public hearing on House Bill 2759.
These people again?
Shit. I thought we got done with these guys on Friday.
Why don't you put this into 134? Have an omnibus bill for these guys.
We'd
be on, amendment number 93.
We tried to do that on Friday's bills, but they said they won't fit. So we have to see them all individually. Okay, Ken Cadell and Steve before.
This is another one for you at Special Ed.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, this sets up professional credentialing in various specialties. I wouldn't say this is particularly based at lead-based paint contractors, but they're certainly loom large in the efforts to get this kind of educational requirement.
Okay.
More Republican again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Stephen Cafori. You'll notice the bill is at my request, but it should have been at the request of the Oregon Remodelers Association. I'm here today representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. I don't think I need to tell this body about lead-based paint and the dangers. We've known for a while that it's a dangerous substance, but only recently we're finding out how pervasive it is and how easily it can get into the environment. There was a study recently done in the state of Wisconsin. They found that an area of just 2 feet by 2 feet of remodeling in a home can release enough dust with lead, if the paint is lead-based, that it can seriously contaminate the house and make it dangerous, especially for small children. The Oregon Remodeler Association is concerned about the health of its employees and also concerned about the health of its customers, and is involved in an education effort to get the remodelers' memberships and remodelers in general trained in how to work with lead-based paint in a safe manner. Let me make a distinction between lead-based paint abatement and just ordinary remodeling. The law And you can see in, on the second part of the bill, section two, it talks about, section two and three, ORS 701. Lead-based paint abatement is when you go into a house or into a building and your purpose is to get rid of the lead-based paint that's there. This requires special licensing and special classes and special instructions. It's a special equipment. It's a different game, but it's also important. It's also different from the people who just go into somebody's house to replace a window or to create a new bathroom or do a kitchen. They're not there for the purpose of removing lead-based paint, but while they're there, if you're in an older house, they may be working on lead-based paint. And it's our concern to get these folks trained so that while they're working, they can be lead-based paint safe. It's not terribly difficult nor terribly expensive, but it does take a day or two of training to learn this. We've applied for a HUD grant, and we are going to be in the process very shortly of training thousands of people in the state of Oregon how to do this. Our concern is that once it's done, if customers are looking for someone to do remodeling in their homes, we want them to know that there is a list of people and of who have been trained in lead-based paint work so that they know how to do remodeling in homes in ways that won't cause contamination. And one of the best ways of doing that is through Construction Contractors Board. A lot of people, when they're looking for a contractor, will get in touch with Contractors Board, either over the Internet or by telephone. And right now we give information, the Construction Contractors Board gives information to the customers about the person's record of complaints. And we thought this would be a good time for them to give information to the customers about the experience or training that this person has had in lead-based paint. We also thought there are other kinds of training experience that people have that would be beneficial for customers to know. And we wanted the CCB to have the ability to give customers that information as well. There was concern that we didn't want to have somebody set up Joe's pretty good construction training program and charge people a couple $100 and then slap a sticker on them, say, yeah, you've learned something about this or that, and allow them to advertise through the Construction Contractors Board. So the Section 1 has a lot of prescriptions on what the kind of training and certification can be that the CCB would be allowed to give out. And we think that this gives protection to the public that we're not going to have diploma mills set up that the CCB would then giving out. There's also a pretty good broad authority for the CCB and its administrative rules to safeguard the process. We think that this will help customers be more informed and encourage remodelers to learn more about the profession, especially in the area of lead-based paint, so we can have safer remodeling practices.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Grover.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon, Mr. Kafoury. How would you describe the link or relationship between this bill and a bill that has been introduced in the House by Representative Kafoury related to lead screening and prevention?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, they're really very different issues aimed at different groups of people. The concept is the same. There's a danger from lead-based paint. Just if your house has lead-based paint, and most houses that are built before, I think, 78 contain lead-based paint, just opening and closing double-hung windows can let enough dust come into a room that can be dangerous, especially for children who crawl on the floors. Ordinary vacuum cleaners don't pick this dust up, lead-based paint dust, so it can be, you can inadvertently be causing a hazard in a home, even if there's no remodeling going on at all. And certainly as citizens, we're very concerned that we find out where these situations are and that children be tested. And we understand that Multnomah County is one of the most dangerous counties in the country in terms of the amount of lead-based paint poisoning that's going on, and I know it's a lot of older houses or what, but it's an area that certainly this legislature ought to be involved with.
Thank you, and if I may follow up, with regard to Representative Kafoury's bill, do you know the status on that particular bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gourley, no, I don't.
Thank you.
Thank you. Section 1 of this bill doesn't specifically speak to lead-based paint in any way. It's talked about any special education or specialized education. And 1B of that section, when you speak to a program sponsored by recognized associations with at least 1,000 members national or 500 statewide, where do we come up with those numbers, and are there any of those associations that qualify, or does this get some in and some out?
Chair Beyer, my name is Ken Cudell. I'm the administrator of Construction Contractors Board. Those numbers they were not arrived at by a scientific study, but what we were attempting to do was, again, trying to prevent someone who represented maybe a dozen or a couple dozen contractors to create an association and have a program. But many associations have an education program, and what the purpose of this bill is to encourage contractor education without requiring it. The purpose of the broader than the lead-based paint, the starting of this, the start of the notion to create a bill that would recognize specialized education programs was primarily geared to the lead-based paint. When we got into the conversation on it, it spread larger than that, and we looked at what can we do with this kind of legislation that would encourage contractors to get additional education. Right now, a contractor, and that's only since July 1, the only requirement that's on a contractor is 16 hours in business practices and laws that impact them. So that's new contractors becoming licensed since July 1 have had to do that. Others may have had a college education. They may have be taking a class and have all sorts of credentials. But we have no way of knowing that. And this would give us a way of knowing it and encouraging it. There's nothing scientific about the 500 members of a state association or 1,000 members on a statewide.
Mr. Chair, the Oregon Remodel Association and the Oregon Home Builders, actually I call it Oregon Building Industry, right? I still call them Home Builders because the Home Builders would qualify under this.
Senator Harper, go ahead.
Thank you, Jessica. Back me up a little bit. What is the problem we're trying to fix?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, the problem we're trying to fix is that there are people now who are hiring remodelers, and often with very limited information about why they should pick one remodeler over another remodeler. The information they can get now from the state has to do with the number of claims that they've had. Especially when it's important, we think, that more remodelers be trained in how to deal with lead-based paint because it can be enormously hazardous. We wanted to give encouragement to those people, and we think that if remodelers know that their education is going to be rewarded by being listed by the state when someone calls to find out who they should hire as a remodeler, that they would be more likely to sign up for these classes. We also think there's it's a benefit for consumers that it's easier for them to find out who is trained in these classes, who is not. And as Mr. Cudell said, there are also certifications that are given by the Remodelers Association, by the Home Builders Association, that where people take classes and learn more about the technical aspects of their trade. And we think that this is helpful information for the consumer.
I hear remodelers, and then I hear everybody. I'm just trying to get a grasp on
Mr. Chair,
what's broken here.
If I may, for the record, this is Jessica Harris with the Associated General Contractors. We support this bill and view that this bill would allow for contractors in our association, and by the way, as a footnote, we view that there is not a group that you regularly see before this committee or in this building that wouldn't meet the eligibility standards set out before this bill. Most of the subcontractor organizations, certainly our organization, the Associated Building Contractors, would meet these requirements. And we believe this is a good piece of information. While we don't generally do remodels, what we do see is there's a lot of education that's available out there, especially on wetland mitigation, on environmental mitigation, those kinds of things that are specialized trainings offered either through our association or are offered in concert with public agencies, that if individuals go through those trainings, they are better contractors for it. Yet the only information, if a client isn't aware of what it is that they're buying when they're hiring a contractor, the only information they're able to get from the CCB at this point in time is, have they ever had a claim or not, and when was it, and how was it resolved? Not, do they have any special trainings or certifications available? This is an ability for the CCB to assist contractors who invest the time and energy in getting certifications, in helping them be able to provide better information to the consumer. And we view that as a very positive step. When we contribute our fees to the CCB, that's another thing that we get back for our fee money, is the ability to be able to say, you know, look at what the CCB has on record, look at our record, it's not that bad. In fact, it's pretty good. So it's a, in a backwards way, it's kind of a marketing tool, and we view that as a very positive thing.
Okay, we need to back up here a little bit. In Section 3 of the bill, it's speaking to the fact that no one, and this is current law, that no one may perform these lead-based paint activities unless they're, first we have licensed and then we have registered under 701-515, and then we've got 431-920 and 701-500-2515. So what is this bill changing? Because we already have these people licensed and or registered by the both Construction Contractors Board and the Health Division.
Mr. Chair, Section 701 of the ORS has to do with lead-based paint abatement. Those are people who are not in your house to put a new bathroom in or change the windows, but are there because you're concerned about the danger of lead-based paint in your house, and you want to have it either all taken out or encapsulated in some way, made your house, make your house safe. It's a very different lead-based paint abatement. Is a more technical game. The training is different. The licensing is different because of that. It's very different from the kind of 1 or 2 day programs that we have for people who are going to be just working in your house, but we want to make sure that those folks work safely, that they, for example, don't use dry sanding, that they use wet sanding so they don't get a lot of dust blowing around the house, those kind of things, ways of cleaning up after you're done. It's not complicated stuff, but it's important that people learn it when they're doing just ordinary remodeling tasks.
So under this bill, no one would be able to come into my house because it was built prior to 1978 and do any work unless they first passed a certification training by either one of your associations or by the board?
No, Mr. Chair. Under the present law, no one can come into your house and abate your lead without being licensed. But that's present law.
Under this bill.
Under this bill,
modeling done.
It requires nothing. All it would does is it requires a CCB to give information.
What kind of bill?
It doesn't. So, you would say if you want to have someone come into your house to put a new bathroom in, and you say, I'm worried about my kids crawling on the floor. I don't want them to be wiping their hands on the dust and putting their mouths and getting lead-based paint poisoning. So I want to find out who's going to be coming into my house to put this new bathroom and that knows about how to work safely. You call the CCB and ask them, and they'll tell you.
But this bill does not do anything. That's what you're saying as far as requiring people to do it. Anyone can still come do it.
That's correct.
Couldn't that be done on today's law that the CCB could already provide this information?
No.
Why couldn't they?
Let me, the question I'm going to have is, the overarching piece of this legislation is you're allowed to tell people what kind of qualifications or credentials individual contractors have. Why can't you do that today?
Yeah. It's,
why do you need a law so you can tell them that they've been to a 6-week?
Chair Byer, Senator Harper, I don't believe we have authority to do that now, because if we did, we'd have to.
Why don't you do it? See who complains.
Well, the problem that we would have with it, without something like this that says that we can approve certain kinds of education. We would have to head out and approve certain kinds of education without authority to approve certain kinds of education. What this allows us to do is say, the board's going to set up rules for what kind of what kind of contractor education programs they will approve. That we don't have today. We don't have any sort of a mandate that says you'll do this. This says the board may, but the board does it by rule as opposed to and creates these rules so that this kind of a class will qualify. Or this kind of education will qualify. Something else may not qualify.
Lead abatement. We have some requirements for lead abatement qualifications. I mean, that's in the statute. Now, don't those show up when somebody calls, or they just assume that you've had... I mean, you do that already.
Senator Beyer...
The qualifications now.
Chair Beyer, Senator Harper, the lead-based paint for abatement does show up because we license them. But we're not talking about additional license. We're just talking about recognizing some additional education.
So the licensing lead abatement contractor went to a three-day seminar. That's what you want to show up in the qualification sheet?
The lead-based remodeling contractor, the abatement contractor, has to go to a longer class and pass a test before they can be licensed.
I mean, additional training, continuing education in a professional role, other classes, other courses. You want that to reflect on information they get back from CCB?
Yes.
Yeah. Starting out with
lead-based. Yeah.
Senator Gordley?
I think... Mr. Chair, I think my question has been answered, but let me just test this. So we're talking about an encouragement, not a requirement. And it's just related to education qualification that you want people who remove lead-based paint to have.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, that's part of it. We want for information to be given to consumers about people who work on houses where there may be lead-based paint. We also want, if someone has had training in another specialty area, the Oregon Remodeler Association, for example, has a program called Certified Remodeler. That's a quite a long process. It requires a good number of training hours and examinations. And we think that if a person wants to hire someone to do remodeling, it would be good for them to have that information. A lot of our members are one- and two-person firms, and they don't advertise in the paper. They don't have television commercials. It's not really practical for them to get this information out to anyone that they've done this. And we think it's important to encourage these folks to get more education so they can do a better job with the consumers. And this just allows that information to get out to consumers. It requires nobody to do anything, but it allows a lot of things that we think are very good to happen.
Mr. Chair. Senator Harper.
Yeah, I think my struggle is, I think it's a great idea until you get to making this so narrow that my carpenters are going to complain because they're not allowed to have this on their sheet. And next session we'll be adding every other thing to it. So why don't we just lop it off above the lead-based contracts and let you guys figure out how you want to implement this thing? Why do we have only one specialty in this statute? Do anything you want to. Just don't come back next year.
Chair Beyer, Senator Harper, I think what you've got in this statute is it's a broad statute in Section 1, and then in Section 4, it mandates that we deal with the lead-based paint. That's the only mandate part of this one. The other, Section 1, authorizes the board to do what you're talking about. And then in 4, it says you will do the lead-based paint.
Well, you guys figure out what you want to do. You might want to do plumbers.
Well, and we can't.
Landscape designers.
Well, Landscape Design Center, another statute.
The water feature guy.
Somebody might come in with an ornamental water feature. But you never know what you might find.
But section, Senator Beyer, or Chair Beyer, Senator Harper, the section one of the bill would allow us, if somebody is a, if there's a special program for roofing, or there's a special program for painting, a special education program, it would allow us to recognize and deal with that. Or if there's one for plumbing, there's certainly already a plumbing one. People have to have a license for that, and we would already recognize that, and the electrician. But some of these don't require a license. They are they're verifiable education programs that somebody has taken and is in good standing in, but they don't require a license. And this will allow us to recognize that and convey that information to the public. You have another bill that would, another program that would be there. I'm sure that Master Builder is one of those that we would be asked to recognize if that bill is approved. I think that's, 2112, that's before your committee.
Okay, I think this, to me it comes down to this. Your number B in under section one, or letter B in section one, about the limiting it to certain associations, I'd like to see more information as to, you know, who we kicking out by saying that if an association doesn't have 500 members, it's no good. I don't know where that number came from and why we chose it. Under number three in section one, the second sentence, the board may remove a professional accreditation from the contractor's licensing record, .. And if you already got it once, how can you say it's no longer any good? I mean, this is, he's already been to one of these things, you know, this thing, you can remove him if he doesn't do more. That language seems a little confusing to me.
Chair Beyer, the purpose, I think, for that being there is that if the credential requires some continuing education, that would be something that if the person doesn't get that continuing education, they no longer have that same credential that we're recognizing, and some of them would have. Some of these would have a continuing education requirement on it, not by the board, but by the party issuing that certificate of competency. It is some initial education and maybe some continuing education.
That seems to be somewhat of a moving target for someone who they've you know, signed up their construction contractor and they went to this, you know, asphalt shingle, you know, installation, continued education or additional education, and they completed that one and they're out happily, they have that on their certificate and they're out there nailing roofs on, and all of a sudden this association, which they may or may not be a member of now, is going to say, well, we thought 12 hours was good before, now we think it's 16, so they're going to send you guys a letter saying, you got to take this person's accreditation off there, because we want him to come take another class because we're a little short on revenues and we make money from these classes, and so we now need to have 16 hours of credit here instead of 12. So this guy jerk his certification until he comes takes another class. I mean, there's nothing here says it had to be how we're going to notify these people or anything like that. I don't know how that's going to happen. I think that some of Senator Harper's roofers and are going to come unglued in their all of a sudden their extra certificate get jerked because they didn't know that they needed to do another time. And then when we get down to section three of the bill, and I think this is what also getting to Senator Harper's concerns, is why are we specifically picking out lead-based paint issues and talking to that? Why do we need section three of this bill? I don't understand. You haven't made a case for that, I guess, to me.
Mr. Chairman, I take those one at a time. The first year issue about the number of members, this was put in for the purpose that we didn't want to have someone and his friend setting up a diploma mill and saying, you know, you and I are great people. We need 2 hours, and then if you put 2 hours in and pay me $50, then we can stamp something, and they have to put it in the CCB. If you're concerned about those hours, Mr. Chair, there's no reason at all we couldn't just give that authority to the CCB and allow them to make the decision about who's bona fide and who's not bona fide. I think we can let them do that by administrative rule if that's a concern. in terms of section, subsection 3, having to do with repeat requirements, again, that's an issue that if it bothers you, and I can understand your concern, and it perhaps ought to be in administrative rule and not in this statute, and that would give the CCB flexibility to make those requirements where it's fair and not make those requirements where it's not fair. I think administrative rule is always a lot more flexible and more quickly changed. We'd be happy with amendments along those lines. Number, the third issue on section 3, we felt that it was so important, I mean, this is really life and death stuff, lead-based paint, that we wanted to mandate that. Where the others, you know, whether you somebody does a good job in fixing your bathroom may be important and maybe make you money or lose you money. The situation of having your children grow up mentally retarded because they've had paint is ingested paint is pretty serious stuff.
It's no more serious than almost any other thing you deal with. If a guy puts a roof on and it falls in on your kid, it's still bad.
Or if an electrician puts a bad wire in and it burns your house down, that seems pretty serious, too.
Let me also toss out, you have an accredited university with a two-year program. I don't want to be a nitpicker, but that would leave out community colleges. Unfortunately, we get ourselves nitpicking if you want to have that many words from here. Some of you guys are making yourself a lot of trouble if you don't just leave it with one or two lines saying... specialized education program, you determine stuff like that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gorsuch.
Lead-based paint, Mr. Chair and colleagues, is a public health hazard.
Big deal.
And I would ask Mr. Kifori to repeat something that he said at the beginning of his testimony about problems and hazards that we find in Multnomah County, certainly not confined to Multnomah County, but there is some older housing stock that is of hazard to children. And children who come in contact with lead, paint, can have their lives irrevocably changed. It's not the same thing as having a roof fall in. I mean, granted, that's a hazard, and that would be a tragedy. But we have tragedies happening right now in many of our communities because we don't do screening routinely. We don't have systematic screening and prevention for children who are coming in contact with this lead-based paint. So it makes sense to me that we would want to not only encourage construction folks, but that we would even want to require that they have educational background and information that helps them understand what their role and responsibility is in remodeling some of this older housing stuff.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, it is a very serious program, a problem, and Multnomah County is, I think, they say Canada is the worst place of most danger in the country. This is what the national statistics have shown. We would love to have the ability to train and require training of all, 40,000?
45,000.
45,000 construction contractors. Unfortunately, that's in the short term, it's not practical to do that. We're just now in the process of training trainers. It's going to be a huge job to do what we can. And in the meantime, before we can get to a requirement that everyone is trained in lead-based paint remodeling, we think that this is a short-term answer that will at least encourage people to, get a lot of folks trained.
No sense.
And if the chair wishes us and Senator Harper to take a look at this bill and do some revamping in terms of making it, giving more authority to the CCB and making it less prescriptive, we could certainly do that.
I think the chair certainly does desire that. And I think that, I don't know, I mean, there's got to be some justification for some of this stuff in my mind, and certainly fix the college. You know, it has to be a university instead of a college. that's a problem. And I think the bill needs some work, and I really do. You know, otherwise you're going to be back here in 2 years saying, well, you know, we got to do it something else. We missed something. I think Senator Harper's right. Allow the board to do it, and why put the rest of it in here? That's would be my.
And Senator Corcoran will be on us in 2 years.
Chair Byer, that one of the reasons for A, B, C, and D in Section 1 is that some were not so sure they wanted the board to have that broad authority. That's why we have 1, 2, 3, and 4, or A, B, C, and D in Section 1 when we were in the House in committee.
Isn't it fun having two chambers?
Well, who are you working with in the House committee that wanted A, B, C, and D? Are you?
I can't recall.
Mr. Chair, as I recall, it had more to do with the home builders than it had to do with members of the legislature, but I'm sure we can get together and work something out that...
I don't even see the home builders in the room.
And because they like the bill as it is.
Well, maybe they should come talk to some of us then.
Teach them.
Thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and we'll bring something back in very short order.
Yeah,
thank
you. I don't want to minimize what lead-based paint fixing up and cleaning up. You know, that's a huge deal, but I think you're just, you're making yourself more administrative problems. You can focus in on that if you want to. Should, but I just don't want to see you back in 2 years. I think you can make this thing a little bit simpler to administer from your perspective.
Okay. Thank you.
We won't move on to that day.
Broke your record there.
That was going too smooth. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2759 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2252. Mr. Pop.
Mr. Chairman, this bill was brought by the Housing Community Services Department. Basically, they have to approve certain loans to low-income people when the loan is in excess of $100,000. They believe that that limit is currently too low, and they would like to move it up to $250,000.
Don Gale.
Good afternoon. I'm John Gale. I'm an employee of Oregon Housing Community Services, and I manage the single family loan program or the residential loan program. And I'm here today to speak on behalf and support of House Bill 2252. Incidentally, it did pass the House on the consent calendar and has received very little, if any, opposition. Speaking on behalf of it, our loan program, just a little bit of background if you're interested, is funded by the sale of tax-exempt mortgage revenue bonds, and that because they're tax-exempt, we're able to offer low and moderate-income families below-market interest rates. So we do that because the tax savings on these bonds, investors pay a lower rate, which we in turn pass on to low and moderate-income first-time homebuyers. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you have on that. The state law currently requires that every loan that is in excess of $150,000 is taken in front of our state housing council. To do that, each family's name is listed on the public record, and they're exposed to a little more public scrutiny than our typical borrowers who simply, if they meet our program guidelines, are reviewed at a staff level and then approved. So one of the impetus for this change would be to limit the amount of public scrutiny these borrowers have to face. Secondly, we do very few loans. The issue that was raised in the House was, well, why are you making loans to people up to $250,000? And I think that's a very fair question. The answer to that question is we're not. We have not this year, and since I started in the position 2.5 years ago, done a single loan over $175,000. This is a housekeeping measure simply to raise a limit to a limit that's high enough so we don't have to come in front of you every couple of years and ask for this addition. So far, we of the loans that we have purchased, only 1.5% of them are even over $150,000. So these are very few loans that in fact come up over that limit. But in fact, there were 23 loans that came to that limit. These loans, all of them, had to be brought to our state housing council for review and approval. And each one of these 23 households had to be listed in the public record. And we're just hoping that by raising the limit to $250,000, that these families wouldn't have to go through that. The loans are loans that we've promised our lenders that we would purchase. These are loans that we have an obligation to our partnership with the lenders to make sure that they get funded. In a lot of ways, our housing council simply is just looking at them and approving them, because this certainly would be a messy situation if we told the lender that we will be buying loans over $150,000 on a limited basis and then had to go back to the lender and say, I'm sorry, but for whatever reason, the housing council decided this particular one doesn't work. So, and the housing council knows that, so they're really more or less doing a quick review and passing on each one of them. The biggest impetus for this is just to protect the privacy of the borrowers, not expose them to any more public scrutiny than any other borrower would necessarily be exposed to.
Mr. Harper, do you have a question?
No, 45-0. I'm not asking anything.
Mr. Chair.
It didn't stop in the last one.
I was
before you up here.
Simply just add that at the House Committee, State Housing Council is also in support of this and testified accordingly.
Senator Atkinson.
Where are these 23 homes that cost us over $150,000?
Most of them are in the Portland area. The average priced house in Portland, even an existing home, is over $150,000. Many of these are families that are right near the maximum income limits, and possibly they are able to put a fairly sizable down payment. But it's not most of the homes that have come under this limit are new construction homes in Portland area.
And what kind of family are we helping here?
Unlike a lot of affordable housing programs, this is a program for low to moderate income families. And so a household can earn up to what is 100% of median income, so $53,700 a year.
And
you want to know how to get in the program? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I'm under that. And this loan amounts, far less than my house. But I'm curious, why is this the role of, why is the state of Oregon doing this? Why isn't a bank, if somebody is at a median family income of $53,000 with a good down payment, why is the state of Oregon doing this instead of a bank? They sound like a pretty safe loan to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, the reason our role is trying to make a loan possible where the market wouldn't be able to finance that loan. And certainly our target is to make loans to people that wouldn't otherwise be able to qualify for a loan. There are certainly some families who are at the maximums and are simply aware and doing their research and finding that they fit under the bar and are taking advantage of this program. So in general, I'd say these loans are probably on the higher side, and some of the families that might have been otherwise to go out and get a loan, just a market rate loan. But the reason the state's involved in this is because the federal government has created what we call mortgage revenue bond finance programs. And with the spread that we earn on these loans, we're able to finance a wide variety of other activities in our department so that we don't require a lot of other state funding or funding to administer federal programs, so that more of the grant dollars go to being grants as opposed to administration.
So that leads me to my last question, I think, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So if you raise this to 250, you as this agency goes, you can get a loan or arrange a loan at 250 for an individual who's under 250, and essentially you can use some of that excess money. Is that what you're talking about, Don?
Senator Atkinson, not exactly. We could currently do this kind of loan. It meets the mortgage guidelines. It would simply be required to go in front of the Housing Council for review and approval. And I guess as a little more backup, this program works because it's a partnership with the lenders. Lenders originate these loans, lenders get the fees for these loans, and lenders service these loans. So lenders are actually, this is just another source of home finance capital for them, similar to Fannie Mae, but at a below market rate. So lenders are inherently involved and benefit from this program.
So I don't understand why, what's the advantage of going from 150 to 250?
The advantage is so that these borrowers who are over this $150,000 threshold don't have to go in front of the Housing Council to be exposed, their privacy exposed, because we do talk about their household income, their address, their credit rating, and things that wouldn't normally be exposed to a public process.
Senator Deckard. Says the council shall review.
Senator Deckard. Well, Senator Atkinson asked many of my questions. $250 just seems high to me for asking for state, and if they were, well, the only question I guess that came out of the questions that Senator Atkinson was asking you, would we forego, if we didn't do this bill, would we forego any federal money that we might otherwise garner? No?
No, we would not.
We would not forego?
No.
Then maybe it's just somewhat of a comment. You can go up to 175 now.
We currently, without the public process, we can go up to 150,000.
We can go up to 150.
And then any loan above and beyond 150,000 is brought in front of the Housing Council. But I would remind you that we haven't done a single loan over 200,000. And of the loans over 150,000, we've only done 23 out of the 1,535 we purchased last year. So it's relative, it's, mm-hmm. It's only less than 2 percentage points of all the loans that we serve.
So I guess, Mr. Chairman, a question. So of those 2%, and I understand it's a small percentage of the total, of those 2%, if you didn't do those 2% what just we would call high-end loans at 150 and above, would that 2% then be able to go to other folks who are hoping to purchase in the 0 to 100,000?
Senator Deckard, not exactly. We would still take on these loans. We would simply then have to go through the public process with our Housing Council. Okay. We've already told our lenders what our maximum loan amounts are. We would need to go through a pretty extensive rework of the program to adjust limits at or below $150,000.
If I may, for the record, my name is Lynn Parton from Housing and Community Services Department, and I would just like to add that this, as John has been saying, this only deals with what has to be put into the public process with people's names and personal credit histories and all of that kind of thing. It doesn't change any of the other program requirements for getting there. You still have the income limits, which by themselves, and the underwriting criteria, which together with the income limits are going to keep the levels of the house prices down. But this statute has not been changed in over 10 years, and we're looking at inflation that has significantly changed in 10 years, and we're just trying to make sure that we don't start embarrassing people in public, and then come to you and try to fix it.
Senator Harper, you have any question?
Do you think that there's, that we're only 23 loans over 150, but do you not think a piece of that is because you had to go through this process? And if we up the process, would we not see more loans above 150?
Mr.
Like Senator Deckard said, if you give somebody, one person, a $200,000 house, you don't give the opportunity for two people to get a $100,000 house.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper. I don't think that it would significantly increase it, as Lynn mentioned. The limiting factor is the mortgage insurance requirements. Everything starts with the maximum household income limit, which is 53.7. And from that, all of the underwriting requirements derive therefrom. So we're not going to insure, if we can't get mortgage insurance on a loan, meaning their house payments are too high, FHA or rural development or the conventional market will not insure it, therefore we will not buy it. So I don't think this particular caveat of the program is not one that is aware, the consumer is not aware of this particular requirement. So I don't believe that they're making decisions about using this program based on that.
What else does this state housing council do if they only had 23 to look at in 2 years? It doesn't seem like they're really overburdening them.
Mr. Chair, the primary role of the housing council historically has been to review loan grant applications for multifamily housing projects. Tax credits, home grants are made through the housing council. They do a lot of they really get actively and almost on most of their agenda is multifamily housing, affordable housing projects, financing, grants, tax credits, those kinds of things.
I don't know what the rest of the community feels, but I guess if you have people in $53,000 income brackets wanting to buy $250,000 homes, maybe their things should be reviewed by a state housing council if they're trying to do it through a state grant. I'm a little uncomfortable, and maybe I don't understand your program as well as I should, because to me this should be for low-income housing, and people who earn $50,000 plus a year and trying to buy $250,000 homes are not low-income people.
Senator Beyer, if I may, it's up to $53,000 now, but there are new charts and schedules that come out to reflect inflation, and this statute has not. So there are all the sets of requirements over here which do reflect changing economies, and then there's the statute about when it becomes a public process, which does not change along with that. And we're trying to bridge that gap.
But if it's been only 10 years, Mr. Hart, In 10 years, if we're now only seeing 23 out of 1,500 cases, it seems to me like the number must be pretty close, because it's supposed to be picking out the, I would assume that these limits were set to pick out the extraordinary cases, and that's when you want to start looking at them. And 1.5% of your loan seems like that's what we're looking at, is extraordinary cases. Senator Harper?
And the rate of inflation over the last 10 years, probably closer to 25 to 30%, when you think?
No. Be higher than that, Eddie? Be a compounder, be around 50.
Mr. Chair, the number of loans that we've seen is increasing each and every year as prices, unfortunately, in Portland continue to rise. So this last year was particularly busy. I think the year before that we had only two or three loans that had to go in front of the housing council. So I think we've reached that point where we're really starting to see some serious increases in the numbers, and that's why we're before you, is that one or two or three in 1999 was about what we saw, but again in 2023. So I think we're at that limit. What we're asking for is to push that bar a little higher so that we don't have to expose them to the public scrutiny again. But they are still exposed to all of the normal requirements of the lender's underwriter review, our staff underwriter's review, the mortgage insurance underwriting review. And so as whether these are good loans, these are going to be good loans whether they're over the $150,000 or below it. So we feel like we're protected from the state as well as the bondholders from any sort of credit risk.
Well, maybe you need to, and we either need to do this on a one-on-one basis, and we can leave that to committee, or we need to talk about it further right now, because I'm not comfortable with what, you know, to go $250,000 home is not, in my opinion, a low-income home. And you know, does the committee feel comfortable right now, or does it need to vote no?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Well, I have several thoughts. Let me ask the question first. How many hearings were held on the House side on this bill?
There was one hearing.
And how long was that hearing?
Half an hour, approximately.
Was there an overview? Probably not.
There was not, and it, we similar issues came up.
See, part of the problem I have, I'm comfortable with what you're bringing to us because I've been around for 10 years, and I understand the context. But that's what's missing for the committee. It's the context. What is the Oregon Housing Council? Where does the council fit in to the department and its policy making and strategies for getting in people into low income and moderate housing? You just, you know, you're here with a policy piece, and there's no context. So that's a part of the struggle I think some of us may be having.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, you're exactly right. On the House side, we had a whole day, with a whole afternoon, basically, with five legislative concepts, and Bob Repine, the director of Housing and Community Services, was able to speak in advance. We had members of the Housing Council come testify, a good number of people who came from different parts of the state to talk about some of our programs in more detail. This was not on the schedule as of Friday, and so we just found out about it and were not able to put together that kind of presentation for today. And I do regret that, I think the people on the House side did have the benefit of a lot more context than you're getting.
Yeah, I'm not confused about what they do. I just number seems excessively high. That's what we're trying to get done.
Mr. Chair, I would simply add that when it comes to home ownership, we are talking about families that are not your typical affordable housing clients. We're trying to serve families that are up to moderate income. These are hopefully families that are going to be able to afford and long-term own their own home. So I think it's probably wise to wear two hats when you think about affordable housing, home ownership being one really targeted to families that are above low income, low to moderate income, and for rental housing, low income to very low income. And so we tend to serve a little different niche of the affordable housing market with low to moderate income. So I think that puts it a little bit more into context. These are families, 53.7 is what half of the population is earning. So we're not serving the really high-end people, but we are serving moderate-income folks.
Before you go on with that statement, Mr. Putman just pointed out something to me that in section one, number one of the bill, it says the State Housing Council shall, and da-da-da-da-da, supply housing for persons and families of lower income. And yet, I mean, I hear debate, anytime you hear debate about tax levels and stuff like that at the national level, that people making $50,000 and higher are lumped in as part of the wealthiest and rich Americans. So there seems to be a little disconnect.
Mr. Chair, there are some terms of art that go along with the very low and low and so forth. Very low income is considered to be 50% of median, and low income is considered to be 80% of median, and then the more moderate income levels for our bond programs can be up to 120% of median, and otherwise I believe this is 100% of median, this specific single family. So they're, depending on the program, there are very different sets of quote-unquote low income that you're talking about. So by way of background, just quickly, our department has a continuum of programs from homelessness to homeownership, and one of our goals is to help move people along that continuum, and ultimately their lives are more stable, their communities are more stable. There are a lot of good things that happen to not just the family but their surrounding community when people actually get into home ownership. One of the things that this program has associated with it, for instance, is a home ownership readiness program. I believe it's called the ABCs of home buying. Yeah, ABCs of home buying. So people who may have been plagued with, say, you know, poor tenant histories or poor credit in the past can be helped into these homes, not just by the money, but also by the training that's associated with it. Before you buy a home, you should think about this. You're going to have repairs, et cetera, et cetera. So there's an effort to take people along that continuum, and this is, in our department, this is our final step.
Okay, Senator Harp.
Sign me up for all of that. I mean, there's no better program in the country than home ownership. I just, the comfort level is anything above 150, you know, I think that increased scrutiny is appropriate. I'm surprised we got 150 10 years ago. I would have thought it had been more like 75, but I said that's just my, where my comfort level is starting to get exceeded. I mean, we should have these things under a little bit better scrutiny, and we should try and get it done, but you know, I don't think we need to automatically go to 250.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harper, I guess our position on that is that there is a lot of scrutiny. The mortgage insurance, for it to get to our desk and for it to get to the Housing Council, first it has to be approved by the mortgage underwriter who says, yeah, this is a good loan, we could do this loan, because there is a risk if we don't purchase it that lender is going to have to keep it. Secondly, then the mortgage insurer has to get insurance from some either FHA, Guaranteed Rural Housing, or the conventional insurer. So they have second set of eyes that are on these loans to determine, okay, does this borrower have the repayment ability? Do they have adequate employment history? Do they have adequate down payment? Is the security, is the property in good enough shape? And so then if it passes that set of rules, then the lender will fund the loan, and then we in turn agree to purchase that loan if it meets our typical requirements. So, I mean, each one of these loans, by the time it ever gets to the Housing Council, has gone through many layers of credit evaluation and worthiness. We don't see the bad loans. And if it doesn't get the insurance, our message to the lender is real clear. We won't buy it. So these are loans that meet all of the standard definitions of the industry. These are not riskier loans inherently. They tend to be loans that are on the highest side of income, buying the highest priced house, and occasionally they're slipping over the $150,000 mark now.
Senator Stark.
I think perhaps some of the discomfort the committee feels with this is the fact that outside of the Portland market, metropolitan markets, there's not much chance that this bill would apply. But where I live, I bought my home for $20,000 on 11 acres. And today I wouldn't part for it for $500,000. And the whole market has been pushed that way, and that they've established a level that reflects, I think, more in the metropolitan region, tri-county area, maybe some other parts of the larger communities in our state. But I think this is reasonable, personally, in the Portland market in particular. I guess I'm feeling like that $50,000 or $53,000 reflects an income that would support this kind of a mortgage level, and it's because they have that upper limit established. And how is that established, by the way, the $53,000?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, it's established by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, published on an annual basis.
Okay. Well, I believe that the very fact that that is established that high, it does support this kind of mortgage, and that we are not jeopardizing the program, or, in fact, we are... simply moving them to a position where they don't have to review so many in the future. I'm comfortable with this myself.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Deckard first.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not comfortable. I think 250 is just too high. I think I could go for something that would bump it up to 175 or 185. And maybe it's just philosophical, is that because you walk through what the Housing Department does, and for low income folks, it helps with rent, is what I heard. And my belief is that those are the folks that we would want to help with home ownership, that would benefit from home ownership, and that's where the state's interest should be as much as possible. And folks that, you know, make $53,000 and can afford it, because I do know in the Portland metropolitan area, and I think it's a problem, you still can find a home for $150,000 to $200,000, a nice home for that amount. And so I would want them to go through scrutiny. If not, and my preference would be for the agency would be that it spends the bulk of its time and resources and energy not helping those who make $53,000, but helping those who make $15,000 to $20,000 to $25,000, the true working poor, that really would benefit from home ownership. And I guess that's where my reluctance, at least with the 250 figure, because I would want a lot of scrutiny if someone's coming in for a $250,000 home.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, I would, kind of a background, this program, what we are allowed to do by federal government is to charge somewhat of a spread. And the spread is up to 1.25% of the loan amount. So that additional, that money is allows us to be able to fund virtually almost 3/4 of our staff in our department with that spread. So when we get federal housing dollars to support homeless programs, or we get federal housing dollars for tax credits, we're able to use the money that we generate on this program to offset any cost that we charge to that particular federal program. So the benefit is ultimately passed on to homeless shelters and by making every...
Mr. Chair, before we go there, I just need, I guess, more information. I think maybe that's the problem the whole committee has right now, is the fact that, you know, I'm a legislator. I make less than $53,000 a year. Okay, I come, I want to go buy a $100,000, $150,000 home. What's going on here? I guess this is something that, I have to go, I go to a realtor, make my offer, it's accepted. How do you guys get involved?
Mr. Chair, we get involved at two points. We often will educate borrowers over the phone and through our ABCs of home buying class to educate folks about how to access home buying programs.
Okay, now that's what this is doing, talking about. No, in the context of
this particular bill, program.
So one of the things you're doing is getting involved, educating me as a potential home buyer.
We do that. We're often referred to statewide, so folks might hear about our program through a press release and then call us.
Okay, so before I'm even looking for a home, or I mean, when I go talk to a real estate agent, you guys are going to be out there saying, well, come take a class from me before you go look for a home?
Yes, sir.
And you're doing that for people in a $250,000 home? Right?
No, Mr. Chair, no. Our focus is low to moderate income families. So most of these families are, again, not purchasing homes over $150,000.
I've went out, I've made an offer, the offer's been accepted by the seller. I still don't know where you're getting involved now.
At that point, Mr. Chair, you would go visit a lender, and the lender would determine what that program best meets your needs. And the lender might, if appropriate, if you tend to fit our program guidelines, if you are a first-time home buyer, if you're moderate income, and if this is the house is under the purchase price limits for the program, then they might recommend our program to you if it best fits your needs.
Okay, what does that get me versus a conventional loan?
The benefit is typically a rate that is 1 to 3/4 of a point below market. Current rates right now are over about 7%. On an FHA loan, you might pay 7.25% right now. Our rate is 6 1/8. So if, for instance, you're coming up against your ratios, meaning your house payment to your income is just a little bit too high for the mortgage and the lender's comfort level, they might recommend our program so that your ratios, your house payment to your income, is within a more acceptable range that can get mortgage insurance approval. The way I like to describe it is that our program allows low and moderate income families a little additional purchasing power. If they are maybe $10,000 or $15,000 away from being able to buy a home, this program might be the program they need to put them over the top.
Okay, so I go to a lender. The lender says, okay, you don't qualify for that home because you don't make enough money and the home is too expensive. But if you go into this program, you might qualify. Is that what happens?
Yes, sir.
Okay. At that point in time, then what? I mean, so then I qualify for the program under your plan, and the home is $149,000, so you don't have to go to anything else. I've qualified for your program.
then what happens?
Mr. Chair, there are some strings attached to our program that are unique to the lender would explain those strings. Usually you're not required to occupy the home as your own home. Many programs allow you to rent it out. Our program does not. So the lender would describe those requirements. The other requirement we have is that there is a recapture provision in the event that the family's income goes up substantially, meaning more than 5% a year. When they sell the home, they may have a recapture penalty that they would have to pay to the IRS. So the lender would go through those requirements. And now you would weigh the two programs. You know, presumably it might be worth it to you as long as this is going to be a home that you can occupy as your own. You don't intend to rent it out. You don't really think your income's going to go up substantially, meaning more than 5% a year, then you might choose to use the program. You might choose to say, those strings are too strong, I don't want it, I will just pass on this house.
Okay, let's assume I've done now all that, and now you guys are making a loan to me.
No, not exactly, Mr. Chair. Okay. The lender would then say, okay, we have what we would call a FHA, maybe it's insured by FHA, so you have to meet their mortgage insurance requirements as well. So those are additional requirements above and beyond ours. Let's assume that you meet those. The lender now has said, okay, we have an Oregon State Bond FHA loan. This is something the underwriter is saying they can do. They review it with the FHA rules. It meets the FHA guidelines, so FHA says they're going to insure it. And now they've got a loan that they fund. The lender, Wells Fargo Home Mortgage, our biggest lender, funds the loan. They basically pay off the seller, and you are now the owner of the home. With that package, that loan file, then they come to us and they say, because we promised them this lower interest rate, the 6.25%, they're packaging a loan at this lower rate, but we're the only source for that secondary market for that kind of loan, because it's below market. Yes. So they take that loan, and then they sell it to us, and we purchase it. We fund them the $149,000. They can then go make another loan. And we hold on to that loan for, you know, whatever. It could be up to a 30-year loan. Yes. And
how are you making money on that loan then?
We're making money on that loan because when we sell the bonds, they're tax-exempt bonds. And the tax-exempt bonds might price at, say, 5.5%, but we can charge again up to 6.125%, up to 1.25% spread, and so that we charge a little more than the actual cost of funds. So there's the spread, but federal government caps that spread at 1.25%, so we can't earn any more than that. So that additional interest goes to help fund the agency.
Okay, does that clear things up a little bit? Senator Corcoran?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think a couple of points. One is to address Senator Starr's remarks. I own a rental in Cottage Grove that I'm fixing up to sell right now that was built in the 30s, very small house, like 1,100 square feet, and I'm going to be able to ask over $100,000 for that thing. So it's not just the Tri-County area anymore. I would submit my brother-in-law lives over in Bend. He buys rentals over there. Just getting into a beginner house that only something like 3% of young families in the United States can get into now. That number might be a little higher now, but that's what it's been. So you're talking about very few people being able to get into the housing market young. And so the other misconception in this is that we tend to think of these kind of programs dealing with the very poor. This is not about the very poor, and they've made that comment several times. And I think, you know, from a developer standpoint, from a builder standpoint, these are the kind of, this is what they want government doing, is underwriting these to some degree, if you will, by knocking a percent off or something so they can get more people into the market. The third point is that nothing that we're doing in this bill impacts what they will be willing to finance for a willing buyer and a willing seller. All this does is it just takes the public scrutiny piece of it out. And I share the concern on one level about the public scrutiny, but on the other level, you know, going back to your situation, Mr. Chair, I think you especially, given your politics and knowing your politics, that you would be somewhat irate if at $151,000 they had to put your stuff out in the streets publicly, but at $149,000 they didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's really all this does is just talks about the public side of it. So I think that's the reason it passed 49-0 in the House. I think it's really just sort of recognizing
the inflation factor in the work that they do through federal law, regardless of what we do in the legislature. It's just all this does, real simply, is talk about what gets public scrutiny. These things get scrutinized no matter what, but what gets this public scrutiny, I think, is the difference. So I'm comfortable with it. When I first started listening to the debate, I had the same misgivings Senator Decker did, sort of like, well, if they're going to be helping people at this level. But you got to remember, too, that $53,000 may sound like a lot. It certainly does to me, being a union guy. But really, you know, two family workers in a household, both earning a little over $10 an hour, would qualify for this. That ain't rich. And I'd submit if they have two, three, four kids, they're working poor. You know, we just don't relate to those because we're older now, and we think what rich and poor meant when we were growing up with our dollars. But the world's changed, man.
I don't know if it's changed 67%.
Yeah, you don't hear no Senator Beyer for point and a quarter. He'd do the hand flips and Macy. My personal problem is the council shall review. I think you should review. I think you should review 150. That seems to be a little too high, but I think you should review. That's where I'm coming from. That's
well,
all.
You know, and I think in response to Senator Corcoran's, you know, if it's 151 versus 149, that sure gives me incentive to beat them down another $2,000, doesn't it?
Chair Beyer, Senator Harper, I would only make the comment that on the House side, we did actually have a housing council member come and testify in favor of this. We actually had multiple of them offer. They live all over the state, and so it's a hardship for them to just kind of show up quickly. But I do want to emphasize that they are in favor of this as well.
Sure.
Okay. Well.
Meet myself.
No. They absolutely will not meet less often. They meet the same amount of time, regardless of whether it's single family time or not. They definitely have plenty of multifamily things to keep them busy.
We will hold this over for another day and let you talk to us, I guess, individually and see if you can either raise comfort levels or come up with a number that can be supported by members of the majority of the committee. So, close the public hearing.
Then refine with whiskey. Yes.
Okay. We now have
Thank you.
Public hearing on House Bill 2668. Mr. Putman, let's see if we can.
Well, this has an emergency clause, Mr. Chairman. I finally get one.
Button trained.
Mr. Chairman, there are some boards and commissions around that have 5-year terms for the members of the commission. That violates the Oregon Constitution. This particular bill takes care of that.
I move we go to work session.
I don't have a sign-up sheet. I don't know if anybody here wants to sign up. We'll go to work session on House Bill 2668.
Ask DJ. She's the only one in the room.
Do you want to speak to it?
No, she doesn't.
No, she doesn't.
You're in support of it.
Okay. Members, I think Mr. Putman described it. We found this last session on some bills. Accidentally, the legislative council would come running into the room and say, you can't have 5-member boards or 5-year terms. It's unconstitutional, and I guess somebody found a few more.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Decker.
I move House Bill 2668 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Decker moves House Bill 2668 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. And Senator Gordley will carry the bill.
Have Decker. He left the room. Have Decker carry it.
I would have assigned it to Atkinson. He left early, but Senator Gordley wasn't here. So. Thank you, committee members. We will bring those other two bills back when our comfort level seems to be increased.
Man, this is the most fun we've had in this committee in a long time.
You have a minute to see what it is.